You have this quote that I love. The Fender Strat hasn't changed in 70 years.
Except for
the frets, the electronics, the neck.
Every time that we listen to artists and they point us in a direction, we want to follow it because that's where they want to go.
When Jack White says, I want yellow Fender logos, is that a huge pain in the ass? CEO of Fender, we're in your office. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is such an understated office. Is that your style? Because some of your executives next door have more guitars and decorations in their office than you do. Is that intentional?
Well, the office may be understated, but that whole corridor of guitars are all mine. And I owned about 30 Fender guitars before I joined the company. It's got a little bit more out of control since, so it's kind of crept up into triple digits. But I don't, especially post-COVID, I don't actually spend a lot of physical time in the office these days anymore. I never did, even when I had one here.
When you go out and you buy guitars, do you play the vintage market, or do you just get one off the assembly line when it comes off?
Well, the genesis, so I in high school, I wanted to be a professional musician. Never went to college. I kind of avoided that. And all would play semi-pro. And by the time I got to 25 and I'd become a qualified accountant and arrogant enough to want a company to give me a CFO title, the only company that was willing to do that was Nike, a company called Nike, tiny little company, $10 million organization in the UK, only a $400 million organization worldwide. So 2 years later, after joining them, they invited me to move to the States. And so at 27 then, I say, yeah, I'd love to. And I gave up my dream of ever becoming a professional musician or making my living out of music. So I sold all my gear, which I sadly regret now.
What did you sell? Anything really special?
Yes. I had a 66 Strat, black and white Strat, which I sold for, I think, $500. I had a 66 Gibson SG with a Bixby. And I sold my Marshall, 100-watt stack. All of it went. I go to the States. I'm in the States for 2 years. A good friend of mine, Alan Rogan, who was the guitar tech for Pete Townsend, Angus Young, Eric Clapton, I mean, just one of the world's great guitar techs, he visited me in Portland and came into the house and he goes, where are all the guitars? And I go, Alan, I gave it up. My dream kind of passed. So he gave me two things. One is he said, I've got this new product. It's called a Rockman. Which was really the first kind of portable...
The Tom Schultz.
Yeah, Tom Schultz Rockman. It was a great little product. And I go, well, that's great, but he goes, what am I going to do with it? He goes, you're going to go out tomorrow and buy it and plug it in. And he goes, here's one other thing, which was A History of Fender, the book. The next day I went out and started my pilgrimage of buying every guitar that was featured in that book, so that every guitar that I buy or have built now is one of the guitars that was featured in that book.
So I've heard you say this before. So what was in that book? All the early 50s blackguards and everything, and then you would basically do what? Comb guitar stores to try to find the guitars?
Yes. So, the two prize collections were like 52 Tele, 54 Strat, which I had before I joined the company. And the one I lusted after is a guitar that David Gilmour owned with the serial number 0001, which I asked after I joined the company if he would be willing to kind of give it to us to do faithful reproductions, as he did with his black guitar from Dark Side of the Moon. But he wasn't willing to do it. And then they went up for auction. He auctioned them all off. So I actually got a chance to play that guitar because it went on tour with his creme de la creme of his collection. I played it down at Christie's auction house in L.A. And the black guitar is really something special. And then I played the 0001 and I was actually disappointed in it relative to what I really thought it was. My expectations were a little too high, but I had to have it.
Yeah.
So I agreed a price with my wife, which was pretty darn high, and it went for double that. And I think the same guy who bought and paid $4.5 million for the black guitar paid.
Is that Jim Irsay?
Yeah. I think he paid about $1.5 million for the 0001. So I went out and had collected every photograph that had ever been taken of that guitar and gave it to the custom shop builders. And not only does it look exactly like 001, now it plays exactly the way I want it. Neck shape, profile, electronics, looks exactly the same. So it's in my collection, but it's a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a fake.
You have this quote that I love, which is, the Fender Strat hasn't changed in 70 years.
Except for
the frets, the electronics, the neck, the radius, the tuners. Does Fender get enough credit for all the innovation it's made over the past 70 years?
I think it absolutely does with committed players, because they really understand the nuances of all of those, you know, changes, which, you know, Leo Fender was a remarkable man. He never played guitar. But he was a very acute listener and a radical designer, in a sense that, you know, when people first saw the Stratocaster, they literally thought it had, you know, dropped out of the sky and it would never sell. This is like way too radical. But everything that's on it is based on form following function. You know, body curves, where the controls and the pickups are selected, how it's even constructed, where you can change the neck out. I mean, there's all of these things that you can do with the Stratocaster that you can't do with guitars from other brands. But it all comes down to form following function. And I think there are, you know, many examples of designed iconography that's sustained over time. The Porsche 911 is one of my favorite, where everything, even the fact that the key inserts on the left-hand side so that you could put your guitar, your car in gear at Le Mans and not lose a beat while you're kicking it into ignition. Every single detail was thought about in terms of form, form, and function. That's the Stratocaster.
Do you think you guys have gotten enough credit for all the innovation?
I think for the average consumer, no. But it's still, for the committee player, absolutely yes. And again, I think one of the big differences between, say, ourselves and Porsche is, you know, you might love the original bathtub Porsche, but the performance of the new Porsche is completely different. So performance with the guitar is completely in the eyes of the beholder. So we can still give you an absolutely faithful reproduction of a 54 Strat. But we just launched the Ultra 2, and that guitar is informed by the very highest level musicians in terms of the very specific things that they want to have in a contemporary guitar these days.
With the Ultra 2, you guys are calling it the most advanced series in Fender's history. What does that mean in relationship to the Ultra 2?
Well, it's really kind of taking Leo's ethos of listening intently to working musicians. It's the body curve, the ability to register the higher register in the neck, it's the electronics, it's literally down to the height of the frets. Contemporary players like jumbo frets, they prefer stainless steel. You go through all of these things, and every single thing that was on their checklist is on that list. And we had to master some techniques. Making stainless steel frets, for example, in volume is not an easy thing to do. It might be easier for a boutique builder, but not for someone who's building at our scale. So one of the great things, I mean, I think another great example of it recently was Jack White's Triplecaster. That is the Swiss Army knife of Telecasters. And he posed a lot of challenges to us in terms of actually construction of the guitar that we'd never really come across. So every time that we listen to artists and they point us in a direction, we want to follow it because that's where they want to go. But we learn so much in the process. And I think that's really acknowledged by back to your original question, it's really acknowledged by the committed player, maybe not so much by the beginning player. But the more committed players that you're a product, the more likely that first generation players will use it too.
What does it look like with the Ultra 2? Did you does it come to the decision that we need a new line and then you start doing research? Or are you constantly collecting research and when you have enough input, do you go, okay, it's time for a new line?
Well, one of the things that a decision I made very on when I joined the company was that, and again, informed by me being a pretty avid consumer coming in. So that very first guitar I bought from that book was an American Standard. And when I that was back in 84. So when I joined the company in 2000, the American Standard was still there. But I think for most people, they wouldn't have known that it had actually progressed, but the life cycle for the product was about 7 years. That's a long time. And one of the things I was intent on doing was creating growth for the industry. And I felt in order to do that, we needed to do two things. One is shorten the life cycle of the product to 4 years. And I'll explain why four in a moment. But also to spend a lot more money on marketing. We were a $400 million company back then. We were spending less than 5% of marketing and all of it trade. So I used to describe new product introductions as trees falling in the forest. Nobody knew. So we set out to spend more money on marketing, spend it more on social media, driving customers to our dealers' stores and our websites. And we picked four because we felt that seven was too long, but anything short of four was too short because the dealer needed to kind of build up inventory and get out of inventory in a commercially viable manner. And that 4 years gave us the ability to absorb all of the intel that came in from the musicians that were using it so that we then factored into the next iteration. So about 25% of our revenues now come from some new product that's introduced. And we think that's been a major factor for driving growth in the entire industry, just picking up the space of product innovation.
How do you collect that information, though, from the players? Are you constantly out searching it, or does it come to you guys?
As of this morning, we have relationships with 3,600 artists, and they are constantly giving us feedback in multiple ways. And then, of course, we learn from talking to artists who we develop signature models for, too. Again, it's been interesting. The Acoustasonic guitar was a pretty radical breakthrough, which again, the brief for that guitar was very simple. Design an acoustic guitar that can be used on stage by contemporary musicians that Leo would have designed. So, you know, that took us down to where the control should be placed, what the electronics should do. And, you know, in that case, there's a lot of great acoustic guitars played by top-level artists. My feeling was what you got from those guitars is one great acoustic sound louder. But if you wanted to use it through effects pedals, which a lot of contemporary musicians do, that was a problem. And we felt that there was potential to actually have a much broader range of amplified sounds that would come out of an acoustic guitar using contemporary electronics. Would be easier for people to play. They could play it a little bit acoustically. They could play it a lot electrically. They could use effects pedals and never have any problem with feedback, that type of stuff. But that was very radical. And we introduced it right at the front end of COVID. So a lot of artists picked it up to use to record, but none of them were on stage. So I see the Acoustasonic, for example, as that's a 25, 50-year journey. And it's great to see Phineas and Jack White pick up the Acoustasonic this year and go, well, I love it. But again, same thing. I just like, if you just changed this, if you just gave me that, we're happy
to do it. Put a chorus feature in the Acoustasonic for Phineas.
That's right. Exactly right.
That'll work. Wait, when people are playing their Ultra 2s, I really want them to appreciate every element. Why are stainless steel frets? Why was that such a challenge for Fender to figure out?
It's not a challenge to do to one or two or three. It's a challenge to do the type of volume at consistently high quality. because it's a much more difficult manufacturing process.
When Jack White says, I want yellow Fender logos on all on my amp and everywhere, is that a huge pain in the ass, or how hard is that to pull off?
That in isolation wasn't that difficult. Matching all of the colors of white on his triple caster when you're dealing with plastic brush metal, that was really...
That was hard. That makes hard. Sense, actually. That would be hard. How much time was spent figuring that out? Did you go through processes where, and you go, oh my God, it's a different color white? And then you go, crap, we got to figure this out.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was down for one of those meetings where, and, you know, Jack was great. You know, on one hand, he's really pushing you to, you know, meet his expectations. But, he, you know, he's not like, look, powder coating the bridge, the Bixby bridge on that was really difficult, because what we were concerned about is, you know, within 2 gigs, the powder coating is going to get
scratched.
And, you know, that's not really something. And he was like, okay, I get it. So we found ways to work around meeting his needs and actually being able to build something. I mean, another good example, one of my great guitar heroes right now is John Five. You know, making all white necks, painted white fretboards, not easy.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Why did you guys decide it was the right time to reissue the Buck Owens Strat? Because Bucks and Don Rich are two of my favorite players. But do other people care about those guitars, or are they so cool that it doesn't even matter if people have a connection to Buck Owens? Or
I think both.
Yeah.
You know, we love going back through the history books and kind of doing collections of these type of products. And I think in this case it will be a blend of hardcore Buck fans and people who just like, oh, this is really cool. I need this.
Yeah. It's such a great guitar. Okay. Fender is going back to NAMM in 2025. You made some points earlier in an interview that you said you would really have to see the value of going back to NAMM. You guys started doing a lot of stuff digitally. What was it that convinced you guys to go back to NAMM in 2025?
I think we really missed the personal interaction with the dealer base. That, I think, is the single biggest thing. So even though we're going back, what I felt had happened at NAMM, which is what had happened in my two previous lives at Nike and at Disney, is that trade shows take on a life of their own, and then it becomes like booth wars. My booth has to be bigger than your booth. And you end up spending tons of money for a very short period of time. And so we were kind of thinking about, is this the right way to go forward before COVID hit? And then COVID, we were compelled to do something differently. And what we found during COVID when we did the online events, we were able to do them at much less cost, but reach deeper into the organization. But we missed that personal interaction. So we're going back, but we're going back for one purpose only, which is really to spend time with the dealer base and converse with them, to listen to what's on their mind, and for us to communicate to them where we would like to take the industry and take the brand. We're still going to keep the online dealer events. And what we'll do is this spring will be in person, and then the fall will be online. So we'll have a blend of both, but we really missed the in-person interaction.
How do you keep the focus of it on those dealer and those dealer relationships? Because I feel like at NAMM, a million things happen and it's so busy. Is it done by just scheduling meetings and making sure everyone has their time very blocked off? Is that how you do it, or how do you accomplish that?
Well, pre-COVID, we had this beautiful, big, expensive booth.
It was my favorite booth to stop by.
It was everybody's favorite booth for the 2.5 days that people actually came through it. And but then we had this massive, what we called the closing room, which is where all of the sales guys would interact with all of the dealers that came in. I mean, we wrote a lot of business there. But again, I think even the writing of the business was less important than the actual interaction with the dealer base. So this time around, it's just the closing room. It's just, there'll be a few gatherings where we want to talk about where we're going to go directionally for our acoustic segment. We'll gather a small group of dealers for that. But generally speaking, no big, glitzy booth, because as I say, I think that's not where we want to go in the future.
Okay, fair enough. I'll miss it, though. I'll miss seeing all the custom shop guitars on the wall. Well,
hold that thought. We will still have a custom shop event.
Okay.
Because that event was really important for two reasons. I mean, again, one, it was as much a social event as it was an actual sales event. So we're going to keep that. And it's a great opportunity for dealers all different parts of the U.S. and the world to kind of interact with each other, break a little bread, have a glass of wine. And
what is your role with Fender at NAMM? Like, what do you think is the most valuable use of your time at the event?
That's an interesting question. You know, increasingly it's more about really listening to what's on the mind of our, and I think largely independent dealers, because Guitar Center's just across the way here. I was at Sweetwater 2 or 3 weeks ago. Again, one of the things about NAMM was always you would spend, you know, your largest account, you would spend an hour with them. At some point, it's actually, I spend ample time with the larger accounts face-to-face in their offices. I think it's good to really spend more time with the independent dealers to get a feel for what that larger community of dealers, because in the U.S., that network of dealers still contribute more than 50% of our revenues. In Europe, it's more than 75% of our revenues. So that community is really, really important to us.
When you started at Disney, I think one of the first people you ever interacted with was Steve Jobs.
Yes.
What was that interaction like?
Well, Steve was grilling me.
On what?
Well, he was not happy with how Pixar properties were being managed by Disney. So I met him for sushi at a local sushi bar with he and John Lasseter at the time. Actually, Ed Catmull, too. And the first question he posed to me right off, I mean, like straight in, typical Steve, was, what do you think makes a great brand? And I'm like, I go, well, I think it's the cumulative effect of great products. And he was, well, that's not a bad answer. He goes, what I would add, though, which has always lingered with me, is that every single product that you make is either a deposit or a withdrawal from the bank of brand equity. I didn't realize at the time he was making that point because he felt that the division I'd just been hired to run was making way too many products of a quality level that he was not happy with. But I think his point, nonetheless, was entirely valid. So, again, when I joined Fender, one of the things I did was like, well, let's look across the entire product line and go, is it a deposit or a withdrawal? And we set out. We said, we're going to start with anything that's in the signal chain. There's absolutely no doubt that everything we've ever done on electric guitars or electric guitar amps has been an absolute deposit. Acoustic guitars, sometimes yes, sometimes not so much. Effects pedals, definitely not. So we set out to upper game in every single category. I mean, right down to cables, anything that was in the signal chain. And of course, the signal chain has changed, you know, even in the nine going on 10 years I've been here. So, you know, products like the Tonemaster Pro are kind of redefinition of what the signal chain means to a contemporary player these days. But that's where we started. That really all came off that one conversation I had with Steve back then.
Just because it changed your mindset into the, are things like cables and things like that, Is it worth Fender's time to make those things because they contribute to the bottom line, or it's just branding to have those things out there? Why are those so important to have in the line?
Well, I mean, if you've been on stage and you've got a bad cable, you know everything that you've done up to this point is just blown out the window, right?
Yeah.
So it's really important that I think starts with brand, right? You've got to make product that's a deposit rather than a withdrawal. But generally what happens, if it's a deposit, the cash register rings. But it really starts out providing, again, working artists with products that really meet their needs. And even the Tonemaster Pro, in many ways, was really affected by some of the conversations I had with Steve. Because, you know, couple of things he said, you know, Steve is very quotable. One was, it's okay to be second as long as you're better. And we were not first to the party with the Tonemaster Pro. But as someone who had tried to use these modeling amps personally, I just felt they were all too complicated. I just didn't want to invest the time to try to figure out how to figure them out. And Steve was very much in, it's all about industrial design and elegance of UI UX. So we really set out to make the UI UX on the Tonemaster Pro. Our goal was, you don't need a user manual. You should just be able to turn this thing on and intuitively figure it out. And I'd say we made a lot of progress down that path, not all the way there. But that was really, I think that's part of the plaudits that product's getting is really comes from that approach.
Was that just from one meeting with Steve, or did you keep a relationship with him?
We kept a relationship through all the time until his passing. I mean, he ultimately, Disney bought Pixar, and then he became the largest shareholder and a board member. So by the time he became a board member, his health was failing, and he was not, you know, his presence in board meetings was kind of off and on. But yeah, I kept a relationship with him through all that time.
You had this thing that you know, when you were at Disney, you had this realization that there should be princess costumes made. And at the time, Disney was not making princess costumes. So you ran up the chain, and they said that no two princesses could be seen in the same space together, even if they were in costume. It would destroy the myth. And, you know, that put up some roadblocks for you, which obviously you were able to get through them. And now it seems like a crazy thing to say. As the leader of Fender, how do you make sure that you're not blind to really good ideas and that your biases might get in the way of seeing them through?
Well, I always like to look outside the organization. I mean, the genesis for the princess idea was part of my onboarding at Disney. I had to go to a Disney on Ice show, which was in Phoenix, of all places. Having a Disney on Ice show in the desert always seemed like a strange to me. But anyway, I went. And because I reported to Michael Eisner, I went on the private jet, and then it was like, you know, you have to go in the back door through the VIP entrance, and we got to this great seat. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to go in the front door with all of the other folks, because I want to see who's actually showing up here, what's the consumer profile for these events. And I was kind of shocked when I'm kind of standing in line with these mothers and daughters in full regalia outfits. And I asked them where they bought them, and they said, well, we didn't buy them. Disney doesn't make them. We actually hand-sewed them. And I said, well, if we did make them, would you be interested in buying them? And said, yeah, you'd like to save us so much time. So I, like, on the next day back in Burbank, I kind of went to the team and said, oh, well, we should really do this. And they said, no, you can't do this. I go, why? He said, well, Roy Disney absolutely will hate this idea. And he goes, our job is to merchandise every single movie in isolation. And any kind of melding of characters will destroy the mythology and erode the value of the DVD vault. Because princess videos were put into the vault, I think, for like 7 years at a time, 7 to 10 years at a time. I don't remember the exact number. My counter argument to that was, well, young girls will have passed through the princess phase before they even get to see these movies. And I feel if we did this, we would actually sell more DVDs. So I made the pitch to Michael Eisner and Bob Iger at the time, and they bought into it, but Roy hated the idea. And it wasn't really until we started selling more DVDs that he kind of came around to a certain extent. But has the only thing that we did to appease him was if you saw a T-shirt with you had seven princesses on the same plane, they couldn't look at each other, which is so ridiculous to even say it. But that was the only thing we did to appease him.
Do you ever think about that moment, though? About, I'm sure there was a level of frustration with the upper management not getting the idea, and now you're in that leadership position at Fender. Do you ever find yourself in a similar position thinking, am I thinking that Disney princess costumes are a bad idea? Or maybe they're, you know, are a good idea with other ideas that come in?
Well, I've been quoted as saying that every decent idea I've ever had has either been violently rejected or got me on the cusp of getting fired.
Yeah.
The Disney princess thing definitely got me on the cusp of getting fired. But, you know, generally speaking, any kind of radical idea, not even radical idea, but even any significant new idea just faces internal resistance. So to get, again, back to answering your first question, I tend to listen to what people are saying outside the company more than I do to what people are saying inside the company. Inside companies, people get territorial. You know, don't want to do that because this affects my business, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That has never... Somebody once said when I was at Nike, he said, the proposal that you just made casts your job as redundant. And I go, yeah, but that's the right thing for the company to do. And he goes, well, that's insane. You're actually just... I go, no, I think I'll be fine. If as long as I concentrate on the business being better, I'll be fine. That's kind of the outlook I've had.
Yeah. When you came into Fender, you made a huge effort to collecting data. And I think some of the data that you found early on was really impactful to the industry. 50% of women being guitar buyers. There's a ton of data that people can go look up. Is there any data currently that has you really excited or is really interesting about the guitar market?
Well, I think one of the things that we're all working through in the guitar market right now, for better and worse, is we estimate 30 million incremental players came in during COVID. And pre-COVID, the abandonment rate was 90%. I don't have the data on this, but I would imagine that the abandonment rate on that cohort that came in is even higher. But let's say 90%. So there's 24 million guitars likely to be floating around the ether that... Don't have a home. And again, there's two ways to look at that. You know, one is there's a lot more used product on the market, and that is putting pressure on the new side of the market. But the more people that pick up the guitar because it's accessibly priced, the more likely they are to stay with it for the long term. And the positive side of that COVID bubble is somebody who commits to the instrument for life spends about $10,000, or much more in my case. So if 6 million, get my math right, 3 million, if 3 million players came in during the bubble and stick to the instrument for life, the retail value of that cohort is about $30 billion in retail dollars over the next decade. So you're going to have these two pressures. You're going to have more demand for new, but you're also going to have a lot of supply of used. So it's walking through the whole industry is trying to adjust to how this is going to play out. And, you know, it's good for companies like Reverb, and it's good for companies like Guitar Center, who have a mix of new and used. And there's a lot of great guitars out there.
Is the vintage market, when Jim Irsay goes out, he spent so much money on guitars, and then just the vintage market has been exploding for years, and now it's probably at an all-time high. Is that good for business for new guitars? Does it not really affect the sale of new guitars, or does it? Or what is there any impact in correlation?
I don't think it generally has a big effect. But where I do think it makes a difference is on limited edition runs, you know. So again, I could see people who bought the Jack White guitar, which I think would be a shame, or the John 5. I could see they buy it, as some people did with the Supreme guitar that we did. They're buying it just to trade it. They'll buy it, they'll put it in their collection, they'll hold it for, you know, 4 or 5 years. So I think, as was the case in my last life in Nike, I think limited edition products can appreciate in value. But I would never encourage people that's why they should buy them. but I think it does help people kind of get, oh, well, why am I really going to pay $5,000 for this guitar? Yes, if you're having a conversation with your partner that says, well, I can sell it for $6,000 next year, even if you never do, it helps you kind of get over that hump. But generally speaking, I don't think it's a big factor in the industry.
Yeah. How much do the staff at Fender stay up at night over secondary builders, knockoff builders? There are Strats, and you look at Strat knockoffs and you go, that is the same headstock, that is the same body, and that's a very commercial secondhand Strat builder. Is that a real problem, or is imitation the best form of flattery?
Well, I think there's, we're very protective about the headstock design.
Yeah. Why is that so important? Because that's what's so recognizable. Is that why?
Yeah. I mean, it's really one of the defining brand identities that we have. Yeah. So we're very, very protective about that. So, you know, even the boutique builders who use Strat bodies or Tele bodies, if they use anything that's approximate to a Fender headstock design, we will issue cease and desist orders. But I think the fact that people just, they default to the Telecaster or the Stratocaster body because nobody's come up with a better idea. We don't spend a lot of time kind of agonizing over that, to be honest. There's always going to be boutique builders, and some people, again, one of the things that I learned in my last life at Nike was, you know, the bigger you get, more successful you become, more likely are people who are like, you know, everybody has them. I want to have my own thing. And that really, Nike was the genesis for Nike ID. It was to say, okay, well, if you really want your own thing, we're going to give you your own thing. And we do the same with Modshop, you know, here. If you really want a custom design, either full custom design in custom shop or a kind of lower level, but still totally custom design in Modshop, you can do that. We can meet that need.
What's the status of Swamp Ash and woods like that being used in more of the standard American lines as opposed to the custom shop? And how much does Fender think about sustainability and, you know, being able to continue to make guitars for the next 70 plus years?
Well, we're very concerned about sustainability. I mean, we've always featured wood that originates from sustainable forests. And, you know, one of the great things about, well, old or even more so in ash, is that most people describe it as a weed rather than a tree, which I think is, you know, it grows like a weed. It's very fast growing, very sustainable wood. Ash has been affected by, you know, ravaged by beetles. That seems to be a little bit on the rebound right now. You know, we're constantly in search for alternate tone woods. And then, you know, if we find scenarios for ash in particular where availability is of heavier forms of ash, chambering ash, so you still get the tonal qualities, but you can manage the kind of weight down to an acceptable level. So, yeah, we're concerned about it. And, you know, we were very concerned when rosewood essentially got kind of pushed out of the market, and actually not by anything that was happening in the musical industry. It was really Chinese furniture manufacturers who were absorbing large amounts of rosewood for that industry. But now rosewood is back, you know, because our use of rosewood, the industry's use of rosewood, was so de minimis relative to everything else, we kind of got an exemption for that. It was good. Our consumers have really responded well to Rosewood coming back, despite the fact that when we were compelled to switch to Pau Ferro, I always used to say, hey, it worked for Stevie Ray Vaughan. It should be able to work for the rest of us. People definitely prefer Rosewood as a tone wood for neck, for fretboards. Yeah, we're always on the lookout for what's next.
Is there a vintage Fender guitar that you think is undervalued in the market? Is it the 90s Strats with the roller nuts? Is it stuff from the 70s? Is it something? Is there something out there that you think is a great guitar that's undervalued in the vintage market?
Well, there's that really gets down to, you know, a lot of people just blow off everything that was produced by Fender during the CBS era. That's a mistake.
Yeah.
There were some bad habits adopted during that era, but there was also some really great guitars. One of the guitars that was in the collection of 70th anniversary guitars was a guitar that was in the book that I collected in Scotland when my father passed. And it was a 70s Antigua hardtail. It's the only hardtail Stratocaster that I have. And the team wanted to kind of reproduce it for the collection. And I said, yes, I go, but, you know, there's the original reason for the Antigua, which, again, the genesis for that guitar was, and this is a good example of what not to do, the genesis for that guitar was Fender reps saying that Gibson 335 was getting a lot of traction and we needed to the design of 335, which we did. We bound it, which we did, and then sold it, and then the binding popped off. So the guitars had to be recalled. And in the course of fixing up the recall, that darker tone on the edge was added to cover up any of the marks that were left. And then everybody loved the color so much, it would then spread into Stratocasters, Telecasters, P-basses. And it's just become a funky color that that guitar has become a sleeper hit. So I have that very first, it's funny just how in some ways a lot of the guitars that were made in the very early years of Fender were consistently inconsistent. So that very first Stratocaster I've got, a lot of people have played it since and have gone, you know, what have you done to this to modify it? And go, absolutely nothing. And it's like, well, this is one of the best sounding Strats I've ever.
The 54 that you have?
No, this is actually.
Oh, the 70s hardtail.
Yes.
Got it. Okay, yeah.
So, you know, it's really kind of comes back to what really appeals to you, what works for you. That guitar has always worked. That particular Antigua has always worked for me.
When Brad Paisley found that blue Paisley, does that really excite you guys? And how much stuff is out there that you think you guys don't even know was ever built or existed from the golden era?
Brad was so, this was his, he and I both adopted different COVID habits. he came across that, the reason I know this, because he was there for the opening of the ARS Center, brought the guitar with him. And I mean, literally took me through chapter and verse, the process he'd gone through to kind of, you know, recreate this. And I told him about what I'd done during COVID, which I had, one of the only things I brought over from Scotland from when I emigrated here was my stamp collection my father and I had built up. And during COVID, I started to apply stamps to a guitar. I had the custom shop put a lacquer over it, and people really loved it. So then I kind of went crazy and did one for every country in the world, which is 195 guitars. and what I'd realized in the process is some of the countries that I had collected stamps for didn't exist anymore, and some do that didn't exist when I was collecting them. But it's really been amazing to see the people who have bought those guitars, because we've been kind of leaking them now kind of over time. It's, you know, that the personal connection between the instrument and the stamps from your country of origin has been really special for some people.
Yeah. So do you know where Brad found that guitar, or was, because wasn't the thing that it was, is it a prototype, that blue paisley, or?
I actually don't know the very original genesis of it, but I know with his guitar tech, he tracked down the original wallpaper that was used on it.
Right.
And managed to find it. And so, yeah, we're, it's one of the little projects we're working on with him right now.
The Fender Strat turned 70 this year. Do you think about how you're going to keep it alive for the next 70 years, or does it just feel so secure in pop culture that the best thing is just to keep producing them and that's going to be enough?
I have no anxiety whatsoever that the Stratocaster will outlive me and generations to come. Again, it just goes back to the functional nature of the design. It's really, really tough to beat. And I long had been a fan of the Stratocaster, hadn't really played the Telecaster so much, but again, going back to Brad Paisley, when we introduced his signature, he goes, yeah, he says, it's just like a washing board with strings on. It's the most kind of basic functional instrument that you can imagine, but it just works. It just really works for some people. But it's even funny on the Ultra. Simplest thing, right? So John Five, I think, is possibly one of the greatest Telecaster players of all time. Has a guitar from every single year that the Telecaster has been made. First thing he noticed with the Ultra was just a slight deviation on where the tone control was. And he goes, wow, this actually works. And I go, that's exactly why we did it. That's exactly why it's on the Ultra. It's feedback from what the artists have told us.
I need to get my hands on one because I've been the switch is also an angle, yeah, too, on the Tele. I'm a Tele player. And I go, what? Is that better? But it's got to be. Maybe it is.
Yeah, well, you'll find functionally on stage it's better. It's just, you know, it's just more organic.
Yeah.
For some purists, they'll go, no, I didn't really need to do that, or I like it the way it is. That's fine too.
Yeah. Okay, we're wrapping up here. Andy, you come across as a very mellow guy. You have this simplistic office. You're in an industry with big personalities, over the top people, and you seem mellow. Is that your superpower in this industry? Or how do you use that personality? Where I have to imagine the artist you deal with, like, it has to be the opposite. They have to be loud and bombastic, but maybe they're not. I don't know.
Well, you know, the three brands that I've spent most of my life with, you know, Nike with athletes, Disney with artists, and now, you know, Fender with artists. Artists are just like other regular people. It's just there are some who are mellow and really easy to get along with. And John Five, Brad Paisley, two great examples. Really great, down-to-earth guys. Very easy to have a conversation with. And then you get people who are completely over the top. But that's just like all of us. Artists are on the spectrum just like anybody else. So, I tend to interact with the kind of A-list personalities, if you like, just based on how they are. I like guitar players as people because I can relate to them more than I could relate to. I spent a lot of time with Michael Jordan. I can much relate better to John Five than I could to Michael Jordan.
Yes, right. Have we left anything out? Is there anything we haven't covered about what's coming out soon, about Fender, anything fascinating on the horizon that we haven't covered, any great stories that we've missed?
No, the only thing I would add is that, you know, as I say, I think digitization is changing the landscape quite a bit. I'm really happy with what we've done with the Tonemaster Pro, but it's really just the first step. We have very ambitious plans in that space, both on the performance side with Fender, but also on the recording side, because we definitely are seeing a kind of almost tidal wave of creators coming into the market who are going to create in many, many different ways from how I used to create, you know, when I was their age. So I'm hugely optimistic about the future.
Is this the best job in the world, Andy? What else could you be doing other than this?
Oh, nothing. This is it. This was the planets truly aligned.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time, for inviting us into your office. And I so appreciate you talking with us about Fender. Andy Mooney, the CEO of Fender. See him at NAMM, although you might not be able to see him. He's going to be busy in meetings, and they're going to have their own space.
I'm sure we'll find time. Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.